second process emanating from the written submissions,
a second process from the provincial public hearings. This process of oral presentation carries the same weight as the public hearings that we held in the provinces. And speakers that are appearing before the committee have requested out of our invite in the advert that we sent out, requesting those who want to do oral, over and above the written submission, do oral presentations to indicate their interest in appearing before the committee. So they are here on the advert, and they are here because they have requested, and the committee has agreed, as you have adopted the program, that they are here. So therefore, these are our guests that we are interacting with them. We are doing this under Section 59 and 72(1)(a), respectively, of the Constitution, to facilitate public involvement. Some of them are bodies, public bodies, some of them private bodies, institutions, organized sectors, and associations, and individual South Africans. They do hold different views from some of us in the committee, and therefore they are entitled to their views. So what we are doing, members, as agreed on Tuesday, is simply to ask clarity on the presentation, on the written submissions, and not to engage and debate with them their positions as individuals. So the Constitution applies in terms of our conduct. The joint rules apply in terms of our conduct, both of us as members, officials, and the speakers. And so I just wanted to raise that in my opening remarks, so that we are all at one in terms of what we are here to do, to ask clarity questions, and not to influence and try and debate with the speakers so that they perhaps amend and change their position. The only thing that they are commenting on is possible amendment of Section 25, as is the resolution of the NA and the National Council of Provinces. So it's the same question that we took to the public hearings. Nothing beyond and nothing less. So please, members, hold that line, that it's to solicit clarity in as far as their position on possible amendment of Section 25 of the Constitution to allow for expropriation of land without compensation. Is the speaker ready? Thank you very much. We therefore going to hand over to you. You have 10 minutes to present to make your oral presentation. Welcome, and thank you for indicating interest to participate to enrich the process of the committee and parliament. Over to you.
Thank you very much, honourable member, and. Thank you very much to the members. I think to start off, we just want to take this opportunity just to thank this august house for the opportunity to make the presentation. We also want to put on record that it is it's a bit uncomfortable for us to only have had seen one of the so-called colored but Khoisan formations represented here, so we just thought that we want to put it on record that we are absolutely very uncomfortable that there's only one of the Khoisan organizations that is represented here, and we are representing the particular constituency here this morning. It is abundantly clear when we look at the coat of arms that there was an absolutely clear consciousness with those who have created the coat of arms in terms of who the Khoisan people were when we look at the coat of arms. So there's no ambiguity or any uncertainty as to, you know, that there is a people like the Khoisan people who is currently falsely paraded as people called Coloureds. The language has got great significance if we consider the language that the honorable leaders who led this process at the time. We are absolutely humbled as a community that the Khoisan language, in particular the Kham language, has been used in the coat of arms. So we just thought it's important that we just highlight that there was what we call a copious consciousness on the side of those who mandated the who mandated the team to go and design the coat of arms. Clearly, there's consciousness about the koi in the sand, and so we want to just acknowledge that. Briefly, the scope of what we want to present, we will not go into detail because of the time constraint. We're looking at South Africa at a glance as an introduction. We're looking at constitutional recognition and First Nation status. We're looking at identity reclamation. We're looking at removal of subsection 7 from section 25 of the Constitution, symbolic handback of the land to the First Nation people for a spiritual transaction to be completed. We then look at a negotiated settlement. We say that that would be justified once we can hand back the land in ceremony to the First Nation. And then we're looking at reparation, where we also want to find out if this house would summons the colonial masters who did some of these atrocious acts of the past. It is Tata Madiba who said to deny people their human rights is to challenge their very humanity. Very briefly, in the overview, when we talk about South Africa at a glance, we see there's a sense that there's somewhat a discomfort and some very strange facial expression when the Khoi and the San community make a statement like First Nation status or claiming First Nation status. We want to be emphatic, and we want to be absolutely clear that in our minds, First Nation status has got nothing to do with number one and number two. For us, First Nation status is absolutely a consciousness that we need to develop among South Africans to understand that this is the people who everybody found here when they got to this part of the country. So there's no intention to dislodge anybody when we talk about First Nation or we claim First Nations status. There is this whole notion that when our community exert our, when we exert our stance or our heritage, then there is this, we consistently hear that people say that we don't want to be black. We want to be categoric this morning, unambiguous, that we are not black people, and we don't believe there's any black people. We think that we have faltered as a nation when we accepted all these false imposed colonial titles. There's no way that you can take people and you can calculate people on the basis of color. We are indigenous African people, all of us. We've got to accept our indigenous status, and this is what we want to advance here today, that we've got to drop this false identification of the indigenous African people. So we want to be absolutely categoric. We are not black people. We don't believe there are any black people anywhere in this country. We've got to revisit our vocabularies and our mindsets. If we go straight into the second issue, which is constitutional recognition, it is public knowledge that our forefathers have suffered merciless genocide by the colonial and apartheid regimes, an inexplicable humiliation and forced assimilation. And therefore we have what we call, people who are called coloreds today, because people were, our people were assimilated. It is public knowledge that the way we got to this title, we know that in 1950 that we were forcefully given this title. Everybody from the Khoi and the San community, including the slaves from outside, we know that all of these people were clubbed together and they were lumped into one title, which is now called coloreds. We are rejecting this with the contempt that it deserves. We are saying that the Constitution in Section 235 is absolutely abundantly clear in terms of our self-determination, that we've got the right, that it's the right of South African people as a whole to self-determine this right, to recognition of the notion of their own right. So this is what we are advancing, that we have a right, the Constitution provides that, make that provision, and we want to be recognized as the indigenous first people of this country. So therefore, we are calling on the representatives of this review committee to begin to understand that there's nobody that can talk about land outside of identity. And that's the reason why we have titled this document that we are a nation and we have a constitution that is cast in contradictions. If we rush to identity reclamation, we will just highlight that very recently, as recent as March this year, the South African Human Rights Commission made some very, very profound recommendations when they said the following under their recommendations, and I quote from the recommendation under 7.1, identity and recognition, the state, through the presidency and the Department of Arts and Culture, must take steps on or before the 31st of March 2019 towards removal of the forced categorization of Khoi and San peoples as colored. I'm just going to stand there and I'm going to say that this it's an unbelievable experience to be in our skin, because when you go, wherever you go, people have got the idea that they club you and they categorize you, and if you don't fit their particular mindset, and then they they vilify you, they cast you out, they put you one side because you look a certain color, but you don't speak a particular language. And these are the hardcore facts.
Are left with 1 minute. If you start get to your position on Section 25.
Right. Let's get straight into Section 25. As far as Section 25 is concerned, the indigenous people, first people of this country, is absolutely clear that Section 25 needs to be amended. It cannot continue uncontested, in particular subsection 7. This is violence, violence against our people. That subsection 7 is barring us from accessing our ancestral land, and so therefore we are absolutely very clear that we want subsection 7 of section 25, we want it totally removed from the constitution. That I will then quickly run and say that what we are looking for, we have come to ask the portfolio committee, and we've come to ask parliament to come and help us return South Africa to functionality. South Africa is not going to be functional until this parliament, until the state recognizes that the people who are the Khoi and the San are falsely paraded under an identity that does not belong to them. We are calling upon this committee to help us with the symbolic hand back of the land.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williams. You are Mr. Williams, right?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Honor,
indigenous, this is the group that is before us, just in case and for a record, is the Indigenous First Nation Advocacy South Africa. Right? That's the group that is presenting. Now, just for a record as well, that now that Mr. Williams, you also make a record, that the committee has responded from the members of the public and bodies, public bodies and institutions, who indicated that they are requesting to appear before the committee for oral presentation.
Sure.
It's nobody that has been selectively left out of the process, and the process itself is not fully complete in terms of people that might still appear before the committee. So there might still be, I don't know, but that process is also not complete itself. So it's not that the committee took a decision and decided on one Khoisan group. There's no decision, no resolution. It's just the process that is that we went through that identified your group, your organization as such so far.
Thank you.
Yeah. Honourable members, questions of clarity, and it's Honourable Mutapo, Honourable Maila, Honourable Butelezi. Anyone else? Honourable Swart. All right, let's give it a go.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Williams and your team for the presentation. And thank you, Chair, for clarifying the issue. It was also on my comments. What I would like to know through you, Chair, from Mr. Williams, is because he's talking about total removal of Section 25, subsection 7. Can't it be better for you maybe to come with an alternative? What do your organization, want this committee, propose this committee? What do you want us to put instead of let's say we agree with you, the committee eventually agrees with you for the total removal of that subsection. Then I thought maybe it will be proper for you to propose, instead of this, put X. But generally, thank you for showing interest in this process. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Maila.
Thank you, Jefferson, and thanks, Mr. Williams and the team. Mr. Williams, you addressed the issue of changing Section 25, but now there's this other issue. Should the land be expropriated? If it is to be expropriated, should it be expropriated with or without compensation? Can you just take us through on that? Thank you very much.
Honourable Telezi.
Thank you very much, Chair, and my colleagues and the presenters. The presenter actually pronounced himself very well in terms of the Section 25. But in the beginning of his presentation,
The speaker is Mr. Williams is requesting that you speak a little louder and closer to the mic.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I was saying he actually pronounced himself very well in terms of the Section 25, that it should be amended. At the beginning of his presentation, he mentioned that land must be given back to people. So I want to understand whether that is meant to say the state shouldn't be the custodian, or he meant otherwise, if you could be very clear on that.
Honourable Swar.
Chair, I would like to thank and honour the Mr. Williams and the representatives of the First Nation group, and welcome your chair, your submission that there may be others that will be invited as well. I know Queen Katrina and other royalty, but I would just like to ask you, relating to Section 25.7 that you mentioned, how you would amend it. Do you have a challenge with the date in particular, and given your comment as well, which is welcome, that we are all indigenous African people, all of us, including white people. So how would you suggest an amendment then to Section 25.7? And if expropriation without compensation, do you support that proposal as the other colleagues, with or without compensation, or with or in that regard? Thank you so much.
Mr. Williams.
Thank you very much. I think if you would allow me to start with number four in that particular order, because part of our preparation, we worked quite a bit on the Constitutional Court case, CCT 19/03. We all know this famous Richtersveld case, where the state and Alex Kaur, you know, fought inconceivably, fought against its own people, you know, essentially. So when we look at this particular case, becomes there's a precedent that has been set by the Constitutional Court. Because the Constitutional Court has been flipping in between 1913 and before 1913. If you go through, if you read the entire judgment of 52 pages, you'll see that they make mention of how the Richtersveld community the land were annexed by the British Crown in 1847. But then the Constitutional Court agrees with the Supreme Court of Appeal that very clearly states that they did not lose the right, the title to that land, and therefore the Constitutional Court agreed with the SEA on the matter. But something that was very clear that intrigued us is that you clearly heard that judgment was written for the First Nation people. Because right through that entire judgment, you clearly hear that the judges, which was Chesterton and Ngobo and the team, wrote very clearly that you cannot look at the law, or rather at disputes of indigenous people through the prism of common law. This is to use their exact words. And because of that, in the final analysis, they came to the conclusion that that land belongs to the Richtersveld. That is land that was taken from them in before 1913. And this is the reason why we say that we support that this 1913 is the impediment. This is the reason why our nation is up in arms, and there are people who are really bitter that in democracy we left the First Nation people outside. So I just thought we must just start there. With regards to alternatives for the first question, it is absolutely difficult to talk about alternatives. As the First Nation people, we don't think that we are the appropriate people to talk about land expropriation without compensation, because we are left outside of the discussion. So we say, even in our submission, we're saying it's really inconsequential that you ask us whether we support it whether we are against it, because when the country started this journey of this new dispensation, And we know for sure that the Griqua National Council wrote to CODESA and asked CODESA to participate as the Khoisan Nation. And up to this day, CODESA has never answered our people. So when we talk about land expropriation with or without compensation, we are not part of the discussion. We've never been part of the discussion. Hence we are asking, let's remove entirely. Let's remove the subsection. And if you ask me for a date, probably one of the first known battles that is on record that our people fought. We were the very first, and Tata Madiba made extensive mention of this, the Khoi Khoi and the San people were the very first, he called us the curtain raisers. It's the battle that happened at St. Helena. It's 1510, right? That's where we fought valiantly, where the Portuguese came way before 1652, and they wanted to take our cattle and the children and the women. So the discussion for us, we are not even part and parcel of land expropriation discussion as yet, because we were left outside in the cold, and therefore we are calling upon this August House to help us navigate a very, very, very challenging encounter that we have experienced. The land must be given back to the people. This is almost a trap, because now it speaks to whether we support a land expropriation without compensation or what. There is no sense if we're going to say that we must pay for the land. We want to be categoric and say that we have lost our lives, we paid with our lives for this land already. And if anybody expects us to come and pay for this land again, it doesn't make sense. Because we were the first resistance, the first liberation fighters for this land. So therefore we already paid for this land abundantly over and over and over again. I thank you.
Honorable Fultana. Honorable Shivambo.
Thank you very much, Honorable
Dr.
Chair.
Dr. Mulder, in that order.
Sorry. Before I actually put my question, Chair, for obvious reasons, I want to preamble by saying that if this question sounds offensive, please do understand it from one perspective, that it's a clarity-seeking question, and it's based on your claim to be the First Nation. Simple as all that. It's not meant to hurt anybody. Not knowing what your beliefs are, whether you believe you were created by God or a product of nature, where did you come from that you claim to have been the First Nation in South Africa? If you didn't come from any other place outside of South Africa, can you provide some indication as to how you were created in South Africa? Thank you.
Honorable Williams, Honorable Fultana, that is not helping us with the subject matter. So you will have good tea and coffee, and you'll get the answers from me. All right. So, Honorable, was it Shivambo? Yes.
No, thanks, Chair. Do you know literally all the public hearings, we had submissions from the Khoi and San people, or people who refer to themselves as the Khoi and the San, and making the same call that the political territory called South Africa today is rightfully a territory of the Khoi and the San. My confusion about that is, how do you determine that? Because the borders which we call South Africa today are colonial borders. Where do you draw the line? Cecil John Rhodes went to establish colonial outposts in what we call Zimbabwe and Zambia today. It's a recent past phenomenon. It's not a thing that has been there for a very long time. Just which part of South Africa do you say we should, if the argument sustains, is rightfully belonging to the Khoi and the San people? And why the need to want to break down or to stratify indigenous Africans and say, no, we are not, because in many instances, it might not be you, Mr. Williams, but in many instances, the submissions that came from the Khoi and the San, they were saying that even the population that we refer as Africans cannot claim this land. like there is a deliberate dividing notion, a narrative that says that we are not same indigenous people. There is Khoi people this side and the same, and then there is Africans there. I want to get to understand that notion of where does it come from and where do you draw the line in terms of all of those issues. Can we please then get that in terms of the clarity, because it then deals with the land question, so that when we deal with these issues, we're able to factor them in. But also, I check quickly, I'm honestly interested in terms of what practically do you want us to do as this legislative body in terms of what you say is non-recognition of the Khoi and the San people. What practically should we do? Should we change the constitution? Which section to deal with that? Should we pass separate legislation? What practically is to be done?
Honorable Williams, it's another question that is not part of the subject. So please don't answer that one. It's going to take our time. It's a long debate. Honorable Mulder?
I'm going to try my best to ask a relevant question. Thank you, Chairperson. I want to thank Mr. Williams for a very interesting presentation. If I may ask, the slide that you are showing is not part of the presentation that we've got. It would be very nice if we could get a copy of what you've got there, if possible. Now, the question I would like to ask, it's quite clear from your presentation that you don't see land only as economic commodity. You see it as more than that, something that can belong to a community. And then you refer to Section 25(7) of the Constitution, and you suggest that that should be scrapped, and the reason being that it gives a specific cut-off date, 1913, and you feel that if that's gone, then you can be accommodated. But you also referred in your presentation to Section 235 of the Constitution that deals with self-determination. And Section 235 specifically says that it should be implemented in terms of national legislation, and that national legislation has never happened in the last 24 years. Don't you think, in terms of what you want, because you have been asked in terms of alternatives, that what you need can be addressed by way of that kind of legislation in terms of Section 235 instead of an amendment of Section 25? Thank you.
Honorable Williams?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. if there's a very curious question, which part of South Africa are we looking for? I think when we started out, Chairperson, we were abundantly clear that there is this paranoia when the Khoi San community begins to exert themselves in terms of who we are as a cultural community and as an indigenous African community, for that matter. There is always, from our fellow indigenous African people, from Nguni Bantu origin, there is this frenzy that we want to dislodge them, which means we want to chase them out of the country, and we are saying that they are not part of this country. Now, that's a very unfortunate perception or notion or understanding of what we are talking about. It cannot be. We are very clear that we know that we've got family who are from the Bantu community, from the Nguni community. It would be absurd to try and come to a conclusion that this land, South Africa, exclusively belongs to the Khoi and the San community. So we want to be absolutely clear that we are not part of any of those discussions. Yes, we know there are radical people out there in the Khoi San community, as in every organization and every community, that says that the Bantu and Nguni people just came in here to take the land, right? We are not part of that conversation. We are part of the conversation that says South Africa must be honest with itself, and in the Constitution, let's talk about the practical stuff, that in the Constitution, in particular in Chapter 1, must recognize that the Khoi San is the First Nation. So that's what we are asking this portfolio committee to do, and we're asking Parliament to do. That is the responsible thing to do. If this government is as responsive to the cries of the people as we have seen during the hearing,
it's the responsible thing to do to recognize us as the First Nation people. And we say, First Nation does not mean number. It doesn't mean that we are saying that we are first. It's undisputed that we are the First Nation. There's nobody that can dispute it. Nobody can ask whoever came to the most southern tip of Africa, who they found here. It is clear there's empirical evidence, and the history that is written, most of that history has not been written by us. And there's argument that history has been written by colonialists, and it is true. But there's enough proof, there's DNA proof that we've got that clearly locate us with amongst the Khoi and the San community. So we don't want to be part of the people that want to bring a wedge between us as indigenous people. All right? We think that it is unfortunate that there are people like that. But there's no thing in our mind that we are arguing against indigenous people of Bantu and Nguni descent. These are people that belongs to Africa. You correctly, I brought this map up there, to put the map up there, because we are absolutely clear that the borders that is now called South Africa, these are colonially imposed borders, that we've got to fight these borders with everything that is within us, because we don't believe that the Nguni and the Bantu people are migrated to South Africa. We don't believe that. We believe that they drifted, because Africa was one country. It was not a continent. It was a country. So we're clear in terms of that. I hope that that answers. And then maybe Chairperson, I just want to conclude with this. You keep on hearing, in particular from the EFF. The EFF talks about African, right? The ANC also made made a very big mistake. Because the ANC talks about, especially in the Morogoro conference in 1969, talked about blacks in general and Africans in particular. And EFF also talks about Africans. And when they talk about Africans, Chairperson, they refer to Africans as people who are from Nguni and Bantu descent. Now that's it's an unfortunate statement that we have derived, and we have come to a place where we have dislodged a very integral part of the indigenous African people, which is called the Khoi and the San people. When we refer to Bantu and Nguni people exclusively as Africans, we've got to revisit that. It is a mistake. This country cannot continue with what we call racial categorization. We are saying, Chairperson, racial categorization is perpetuating racism. For as long as we put people in boxes of white and black and colored, that's how long we are perpetuating racism. We are the First Nation. We are you are asking who we are. We are your father and we are your mother. You are coming from us. That's who you are. You are our children. So we must stop this thing of racially categorizing people. This is the elephant in the room. I thank you, Chairperson.
I think that's the best way to conclude it, Mr. Williams. We want to thank you for making your time and appear before the committee. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Do we have Every Nation Church? You present. All right. Thank you very much. As you get ready, we are ready. Now we are getting ready. We are ready. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. My name is Simon Lerofolo. I'm an engineer by training and currently a pastor at Every Nation Church in Johannesburg. My colleague here, Gareth Stead, and I are representing Every Nation South Africa, formerly known as His People. Gareth is based here in Cape Town. Every Nation is in 50 cities and towns in South Africa, and we are in 78 nations globally. We also have a campus ministry in most of the tertiary institutions in South Africa. This means that we also represent the young people of South Africa. I would like to start with a story before I give our presentation and our stance on the matter at hand. Just over 10 years ago, my family and I received land through land restitution, and we are grateful to our government for making that possible. Our land is between Potchefstroom and Klerksdorp. It is a land where my father, my grandparents, and my great-grandparents grew up. Our clan name is Barolong Bomodibuwa. The approach we took with this land was to build a relationship with the farmers while entering into a contractual relationship or lease agreement for 99 years. Our rationale was that the land is vast and there are parts of the land that were not used or lying dormant. My uncle left his job and together with many of our unemployed family members, relatives and clan members moved back and started farming. The progress of development has been very slow, and this is mainly because of lack of adequate support. The main reason I share this story is to indicate that there is a different way, especially when we choose to work together, and land can be restored and redistributed, but without the necessary and adequate support, it can go to waste. Chair, as a church body, we feel called to speak into the affairs of the nation. The church has a prophetic voice and a prophetic role to play in the nation. Therefore, we appreciate the opportunity to make this presentation today. We have had a consultation process with our constituencies and have deliberated on the biblical view of land ownership and land reform. The Bible is not without examples of landowners or also examples of agricultural purposes. It is acceptable to God for individuals to buy and own property as long as they remember who allowed them such a privilege. The Bible encourages this principle of ownership and stewardship of land by individuals and households. Title deeds should be in the hands of as many people as possible. This gives people access to capital with ability to borrow against the land and sell it if they need to. More importantly, however, Scripture encourages willingness to share the benefits of such ownership with others. Decentralization of ownership and stewardship to individuals and communities rather than tribal authorities and the state as direct owners leads to prosperity of many rather than just enrichment of just a few. We believe the Bible provides following principles that we want to emphasize today. Love, acting with honor and respect towards one another. Justice, where someone has lost and had something stolen, it should be returned or an acceptable restitution should be made. Fairness, restitution should be made in a way that does not unfairly prejudice a single person or group, but should be carried by original perpetrator or group perpetrators. Chair, the essence of our presentation is that we do not see a need in amending the Constitution in its present form as it already provides for land expropriation without compensation. We would like to put this seven proposals to the committee. The first one being, it is our view as Every Nation that the Constitution in its present form is not lacking, nor it is an impediment to land reform. Section 25 does not protect property, it merely protects the owner against arbitrary deprivation of property. Deprivation that is not arbitrary is therefore permissible. The government's power to expropriate does not depend on the willingness of the buyer. It merely requires that compensation be just and equitable. South Africa should therefore abandon the idea of a market-driven approach to land reform. It is clear that a willing buyer, willing seller principle will in many cases hamper the process of reform. Number two, preference for peaceful voluntary resolution of land dispute. This approach of alternative dispute resolution encourages voluntary peaceful resolution of a dispute in a way that results in win-win outcomes for both sides, leaving parties with a relationship to maintain thereafter. Whereas in litigation, each party is concerned with its right to win and cares least about the relationship. So in our view, we're proposing alternative dispute resolution, just like the CCMA. Litigation, by its very nature, is adversarial, hostile, and results in win-lose outcomes. We as a church are also willing to help and play a role in mediation and conciliation processes. Number three, mechanisms for success, ensuring that land reform policy is made user-friendly so as to cater for simple, clear, unambiguous, quick solutions will go a long way in bringing redress. In addition, administrative functions run by competent and ethical administrators should be better managed and ensure efficiency and better productivity, a system that would also need to be put in place to ensure beneficiaries are properly identified and processed. Number four, Chair, is voluntary surrender of land, which we haven't had it been mentioned in the last couple of days. Landowners who willingly surrender their land, or better, still surrender their land and take young black land developers under their guidance to develop land should be lauded and thanked for this demonstration. There has been news and reports, for example, David Porter and his wife Elaine in the Winelands transferring 22 houses and that are built on 4-hectare site, and this was on Sunday Times on the 2nd of September. Also, the President recently indicated that government land should be the first to be targeted for redistribution, especially in the urban areas. Number five, before I go to my last 2 points, alternatives to land redistribution. Whereas we also realize that there may be some South Africans who may not be looking necessarily to get land back, other forms of compensation could be considered and negotiated. As previously stated, the land issue may not necessarily be about the land for most South Africans. It may come down to what constitutes proper economic justice for all. Also, Freedom Charter states that the land shall be shared among those who work it. Therefore, those who would prefer not to return to the land or work the land could be compensated by other means. Number six, lessons learned elsewhere. South Africa has also operated in isolation in dealing with land challenges. Lessons can be learned from experiences in other African countries, to mention a few, Tanzania, Kenya, and Ethiopia. Finally, the issue of funding. Chair, the government could give consideration to establishment of National Land Reform Fund, where all South Africans could contribute financially to be administered through public-private partnership program, which also go a long way in bringing the gap, bridging the gap of mistrust between government and the private sector. The fund could be two-pronged. On one hand, have land acquisition arm, and on the other hand, operational revolving loan fund. An African success story that could draw us to this is the one-acre farm in Kenya. The one-acre farm started with 38 farmers in Kenya in 2006. And within a period of 10 years, it's now operating in Burundi, Rwanda, Angola, Uganda, DRC, Tanzania, Malawi, and having reached 600,000 farmers participating in this revolving fund, aiming to reach 1 million farmers by 2020. They estimate that one farmer is able to feed 5 family members. A million farmers will extricate 5 million people out of grinding and abject poverty by 2020. So in conclusion, we would like to submit that our view on land reform is informed by biblical principles of justice, reconciliation, stewardship, restitution, restoration, and love to maintain peace in our nation. We maintain emphatically and unequivocally that changing Section 25 of the Constitution to expropriate without compensation is not necessarily helpful. The Constitution in its present form allows for just and equitable compensation, which need not be be market-related compensation. Alternative methods of land reform should also be considered, such, for example, as the expropriation bill. Thank you, Chair, for the time allotted to us.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Clarity seeking questions. Honourable Maila. Honourable Mukwili. Honourable Shivambo. Honourable Mbabama. Honourable Fultana and Honourable Swart, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. This is the presentation from every nation, Chair. So you quoted the Freedom Charter, especially where it says the land shall be shared amongst those who work it. Can you make me understand, just unpack that to make me understand what you understand by who works the land? Mm-hmm. That those should be the people who share the land.
Do you prefer taking a few questions or one by one?
We can answer. Thank you, Honourable Member. To mention and quote from the Freedom Charter is to say that if the Freedom Charter says the land must be shared among those who work the land, it means there has to be an intention to work the land, to develop the land, to farm the land. So it's broader than just farming, but it means developing the land beyond just the farming. That is our understanding of the Freedom Charter.
Thank you very much, Chair. Ntate Moruti, ke solofela gore sengwe le sengwe so se buang le so se practicing, you based everything in a Bible. Now, I want to check with you, there is any scripture in the Bible that says, I'm a Christian by the way, that says people must have title deeds. Ownership and title deed in a Bible. If there is, please tell me. And also, biblically, I was telling Muruti Meshwe this week that biblically, for Israelites to conquer nations or to have land, they had to go on from Egypt, conquering smaller nations up until today. What is happening between the Israelites and the Palestinians. Now, I want to check with you, in your narrative, who do you consider the owners of the land in South Africa, to be specific? Thank you.
I will answer the question, and I'll also ask my colleague to add to it. So, the scripture is very clear on land ownership and stewardship. So just as you have highlighted the Israelites moving from one place to another, it is very clear in Deuteronomy and in Exodus that where they settled, they had ownership of the land. And it continues to speak about individuals owning the land. So the Bible is clear about that. The question of title deed is in the days we're living in now, that there is a contract that you sign, there is a proof that you own that particular property. So in this instance, we use title deeds as just a proof that you do own a property. Not to mention that scripture is very clear that there is ownership and ownership is important.
Can I do a follow-up, Chair?
The colleague is still adding.
If I could just add as well, Chair. So the principle of stewardship, I think, is very important here, because from Genesis to Revelation, the scriptures emphasize this principle. So there's no scripture that says thou shalt have private title deeds. In fact, the only scripture that really speaks definitively is that God owns the land. But then God delegates the stewardship of that land to people. And the pattern throughout scripture is that the ownership should be decentralized as much as possible. So there are many examples in Scripture, both Old and New Testaments, where God is displeased with the state's ownership of the land beyond reasonable measures, and even private ownership beyond that which is fair and reasonable. So the decentralization of ownership as a stewardship mentality is encouraged by the scriptures.
Honorable Gwele, follow up.
So do you agree with me that God gave the state the total control of the land?
Maybe to say that God gave the state total control, we cannot give a scripture to that. We can give scripture to the fact that Psalm 24 says the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And then he gives stewardship, going to Genesis, for people to steward the land.
So
it's not the state, it's the individual.
Thanks, Chairperson. Do you know I've got a fundamental problem with churches that misuse the Bible to justify reactionary positions. In the same way that...
Sorry, Chair, the point of order. Point of order, Chair. This is
the white colonial settlers.
Okay.
Can we hear the point of order?
He is debating, the Honourable Member is debating the issue. And he's put in a position.
Hold on, Honourable Shivambo. Let me hear the point of order first.
Chair, you wrote at the beginning that you'd have points of clarity, not debates. Here we have the Honourable Member put in the EFF's position that he has a fundamental difference from this biblical position. And I think that you should rule is out of order. We are requested to ask questions of clarity, not to put a party position at this stage. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Yes, Honourable Mutabo.
Honourable Shivambo is just starting to state his case, isn't it? Can't we just allow him to say whatever he says? Then as soon as he finishes, then you can be able to rule if he is in order or not. He's just starting. With due respect.
Yeah. No, it's fine. Honourable Shivambo, can you conclude?
No, thanks, Chair. Yes. I don't understand this intolerance of ACDP, which also tried to misuse the Bible to mislead people. Like, I've got a set of problems.
We'll engage on that debate later.
When you want to argue a political point, you then misuse the Bible to justify. You say that your objection to amending the Constitution is based on the Bible, on biblical values. And you speak about the land belonging to God and stewardship given to the people. But how do you justify that in South Africa, the people is white people only? And that has been... majority of the land is owned and controlled by white minorities. And that is because of colonialism, of forced removals of black people, of violence against black people, of forceful dispossession of the land of black people. And then we say that we must not change the constitution. Of course, there was an agreement in 1994 for politics to happen, which said that let us just leave property in the manner in which apartheid had designed it, had inherited it, had got to structure it. And then you come there and then you then say the Bible says we must not change the constitution that has solidified the past inequalities. Should we then take this church serious? What kind of church is this that says that we must just leave things as they are?
But I think you've made your point.
There's a massive inequality.
They will clarify the position.
Should we trust you as a genuine church, or you're just abusing the Bible to come and speak reactionary and wrong politics?
Honourable Shivambo, the latter part of your comments are out of order.
Thank you.
We say we cannot question South Africans' legitimacy in their position. It's wrong. Every citizen here in South Africa, whatever their view they hold, they are legitimate with their view. Yeah. Please, engage in a political space, but for now we're in a parliamentary process. I think you got the question. The question is just to... let me leave it to you.
Chair, we're very happy to answer the question. I don't know if Honorable Shivambo was here when we started. I shared the story of the fact that my family and I, we have received land back through land restitution, and we are grateful for that.
our position, just to clarify, we are not saying the Constitution should not change because of the Bible. We are saying the current Section 25, as it is, it allows for land expropriation without compensation. So that is our basis for our submission. The principle that we put forward in terms of the Bible is going forward, how do we then redistribute the land and work the land to make sure that the land is not laying dormant without being used. So I hope Honorable Shivambu understands that we are not necessarily saying we're using the Bible for not changing the Constitution. Our position is clear on that.
He was saying that there are people that are dispossessed. So if you're using the Bible, what is your position then with those that are not having the land?
We support restitution. We are behind restitution.
Honorable Babama.
Thank you, Chair. Dante Moruti, on page 3, you talk about the Bible providing the following principles that help in your approach. And I'm specifically talking to point number 3, fairness, where you say restitution should be made in a way that does not unfairly prejudice a single person or group. And then you go on to say, but should be carried by the original perpetrator or group of perpetrators. Could you explain that for me, to me, please, what you mean by that last part of the sentence?
So as we have stated that we support restitution, this statement is to say that people who had taken land should restore land, should restitute the land back to the people. And we are simply saying that the state should not take the responsibility alone to restitute and pay for the land. So the people who took the land also have the responsibility.
Honorable Fritana.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thanks for the presentation. My take is that in essence, most of what you suggest is that government has been, is what government has been trying to do through the willing buyer, willing seller, you know, process, so to speak. It has failed. Paragraph 4.4 in page 9, second paragraph thereof, point 4.4, the second paragraph, refers to a process whereby you're suggesting increasing taxes on farms that are not, that are clearly not productive due to excess land. Now, if we were to follow your suggestion, include that suggestion in that paragraph 4.4 as well as others, do you think that, don't you think that that is too burdensome, a process, given all the steps that one would have to go to, looking at each farm and say so many hectares here are not being productive? Do you think that it is possible for any government in any part of the world to be able to achieve anything if you're looking for hectares that are not used and you're trying to restore, you're trying to restitute? Is it a possible, a practicable solution that you are suggesting there? I just want to understand you and not judge that, you know, it's not practical, but I want your response, you know, there too. Can we achieve, you know, restoration as well as restitution through that apparently burdensome process, administratively speaking? And also, if you're looking for certain people that you are going to tax, maybe some people would object to that very process on the basis that it is unconstitutional and that you are being selective, whereas there are other forms of finding people who are not using. Let's say someone has got an 8-bedroom house and they're only using 2. A farmer could very well object and say, hey, there's Mrs. So-and-so here down the road. They've got 8 bedrooms, but they're just living as husband and wife. I've never seen anyone visiting them. Why don't you tackle them as well? Why come to my farm? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Chair, I think this issue of voluntary surrender, I think the main point, I think, that we were trying to highlight, which I hope will answer the question, is one of incentivizing that process. It's obviously not the only suggestion. It stands in with the other 7 suggestions, but it's a very important one as well. It has been happening a lot, but incentives will make it happen more and faster. and then on the other side, the disincentivization where that land is lying idle. And there's no need, that doesn't necessarily mean it'll become a burden on the state to go and investigate that. I think taxation and tax laws have been used very effectively to incentivize and disincentivize certain behaviors. The onus of proving that is usually on the individual or the corporation being taxed that has to prove that they are within those laws. So this really can become a very effective way with little amendments to make it work.
Follow up, Chair?
Yeah.
Quick one. Thank you, Chair. In this context, willingness, as in buyer, seller, as well as volunteering, are synonymous. In this context, I repeat. Do you think, and then at the end of the day, you're talking about settling for crumbs here, only that land which is not being used, when politically we're trying to resolve a problem which affects millions of people and millions of hectares. Do you think your process would help solve the current problem in the country?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Just to mention, I guess it's important to realize that's not the only suggestion that we are putting to the table. It's in line with the others, which we have mentioned that the willing buyer, willing seller has not really served the country in the last couple of years that we've tried it. So we're saying, let's try something different. Let's incentivize. So even if it takes a long process, but we want to do it, it will be something that will help us to accelerate the process. And already, as I've stated in the news, there has been people who've voluntarily given land, so it is happening. But like I say, it's not just this. We're saying other parts of land should also be redistributed, not just the current land that is with the farmers.
Honourable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, as a believer during the public hearings, I really was moved by the deep pain of dispossessed people. And I was also moved by the attempts of farmers to redress this. But you're the second church that is coming to make presentations, and we welcome that because the churches can play a key role as your approach to Section 25 indicates, the role of balancing restorative justice with nation-building, peace and reconciliation. Have you considered the expropriation bill? You've referred to it on page 11. You refer to the current bill and making submissions along line that to improve the situation. And what role do you see the church playing going forward with restorative justice, peace, reconciliation, and love in our nation? Thank you, Chair.
Chair, just to mention, in answering the question, preference for peaceful voluntary resolution. As a church, we would like to play a role even in mediation and conciliation processes between the people who have dispossessed land and the people who currently own the land. We have cited CCMA, which is in the labor laws, has helped to actually many people who have had problems in terms of labor. In this case, we also feel like, as a church, we can play a role between the current farm owners and those who have been dispossessed. And this will take us away from necessarily going to the courts. So we are, as a church and the body of Christ, willing to help in that process.
Honorable Telezi.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I've got one question to the presenters. Tell me what they say on page 4. Which speaks to decentralization of ownership and stewardship to individuals and communities as opposed to traditional authorities and the state. And they say if the stewardship and ownership is to the state and traditional councils, then that will enrich a few, those that are in authority. My question is, does the church view the state as self-imposed individuals who serve their own interest, or people who are elected by the people to serve the interest of everyone, and also do they view them as individuals as opposed to an institution for the people, if I'm making sense?
Pastor?
Thank you for the question. The answer is we very much see the state as elected by the people. It's a an institution that's also biblically mandated to play key roles in passing legislation, in addressing injustice, and in serving the people. However, it's not the only institution. It is the institution of the church, institution of the family, of civil society. Those are also important institutions. And so I hope I'm answering the question that we very much respect the role of the state, the election of the state, the will of the people, those democratic principles we also see as biblical ideas and important principles that are serving the nation. I think this point you're referring to on page 4 here is to just highlight the danger when the state becomes God and owns all the land, or then the people become subservient to the state rather than equal members of a society where everyone serves and loves one another and thereby honors God in the process.
We're concluding with Honorable Mutabo.
Based on the principles of love, justice, and fairness, how do you reconcile this with your lambasting of tribal authorities, which are custodian of communal land in rural areas? And also on the principles of love thy neighbor as thyself.
Chair, just to say it was not our intention, and we are not lambasting tribal authorities. We honor them. My great-grandfather was a chief. I'm in the land currently where we still honor the chiefs. So in this case, we're simply saying there is a way to encourage individual ownership of land and communities owning land in order to develop the land. So it's not just sitting with a few individuals. So this is the heart which it is coming from.
Honorable Kodi, let's conclude with you.
Baba, Simanzi. Angibonge, Baba. I sincerely hope I'm not misreading your presentation. I've tried to read it over and over again, and I think that's why I'm almost the last one, because I really wanted to be sure that I understand you very well. I also have a challenge with separating the perspective of the church and the dictates of the Bible. Because I look at these as hopefully two separate elements. If the church has a view as an institution, it's fine. It has a right to do so. But the moment that perspective is presented as an injunction from the Bible, I would have imagined that in your presentation you would have taken your time to really bring out those aspects and elements from the Bible, almost verbatim, actually verbatim, so as to make your argument. But to merely make reference and say Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 12, 17, when I don't have the Bible here with me to make reference to see if indeed you're correctly quoting the Bible or not, it does not assist in advancing your argument, because it merely creates a question mark in my mind whether or not that is correct or not. Secondly, Chair, reading through your presentation, it's almost as if there is no sense of history. There's no perspective on why we're sitting here today. And I don't get a feel or a sense that the church has any feeling for the poor, for the dispossessed. If anything, the contradictory paragraphs in your presentation that almost does not say anything is actually a defense for those who currently own the land. That for me is how how you come across. If you go to page 3, your points 1, 2, and 3, if you take 2 and 3, justice and fairness, they almost cancel each other. And I think the earlier question was correct, that the last part of your point 3 suggests that those who currently have the land should actually be the ones who drive the process. Your addition of classification does not help your case, because if I give this document to somebody else who does not have the benefit of your presence, that is what they are going to go with. So I'm just saying, Chair, even if you go to the first paragraph on page 3, where the Bible is said to encourage, does it encourage or is it mandatory? Does it say specifically that ownership should be private, or does it encourage? So it encourages, you can do it, you can't do it. And then in bold letters you say that title deeds should be in the hands of as many people. Send in complete sentence. So you can have some who don't have titles, you can have others who have titles, but your aim should be to have as many as possible to have titles. I think it doesn't go far enough except to say that your intention was to come and defend the haves by whatever means, and does put a hastily put together presentation that is contradictory, but at the end of it all says keep the status quo.
Thank you. Pastors, you will then, as you reply shortly to clarify Honorable Goji, you will then conclude.
Thank you, Honorable Goji. Just to mention, because of time, we went with the approach where we did not quote the scriptures verbatim, but we would be very willing to do that. On the issue of history, in our presentation, the written submission, we did put history to acknowledge the pain of the dispossessed. And again, because of time, we were not able to dwell into that and how the current land reform processes have not been able to accelerate the process of land reform. And finally, I just want to mention that if we look at our presentation, what we are driving here is how can we accelerate the process of land reform to get the land to as many people as possible and for people to work the land. Based on my experience with the land that we have as a family, unless we empower the individuals to work the land will just lay dormant and not being used while people are sitting with title deeds. Thank you.
We want to thank the Every Nation Church's representatives, the pastors that were with us, for making an effort and enrich the process. We thank you very much. Members, there's coffee and tea, so you can also ask further questions and engage in a political space debate with the pastors. Let's grab tea. 5 minutes.
It's not worth printing. over to you, and those here can listen if they want to. All the conversation does is tell us what actually happened in the week that we had. And then a few, for instance, in the laws that are not going to be present.
I had to go and get the details.
How are you?
I'm well.
Where's this Every Nation
okay.
Church?
We are all over. Our main one is at...
You can't be all over because I'm not... Are you in
Popo? We are in Polokwane.
Where in Polokwane? Because I know the whole of Polokwane.
The university campus.
Which one?
The University of Limpopo.
In Polokwane?
Well, it's...
No!
It's just outside the city.
That's where I come from. That's where I come from.
I don't think it's church, where? The church of campus.
Where?
Campus church in Polokwane?
No, that's where I come from. I come from church of
campus.
It's right inside. Do you have black members besides the panda?
Majority.
But you seem not to be.
Hey, mama.
Their part of the G was answered. You guys have black members.
I did. I think sometimes people aren't interested in
John.
They want to make their statement.
No, never. Okay, I need to...
It's nice to see you, man.
Yeah, it's lovely. How are you?
So wait, let's put that before.
And Facebook. Just the man, you know, we have been saying
finding a list. We will
I'm going to fall. I can't, it's like, not like in the Bible, because the Bible says, The Bible says, if you slap me this side, I give you this side. But this, nowadays, if you slap them, they give you a side.
Settle. Our next presenter is called Chidi Adenis, and it's Mr. Madume Chidi. I hope I pronounce that name and surname very well. Over to you, sir. You have 10 minutes to present. I think, sir, you must put the microphone on.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the advice. Much valuable. I'm trying to open my presentation from the laptop, but in the meantime, whilst I'm struggling, maybe I should proceed. Let us live and fight for freedom in South Africa, our land. This is a statement we make all the time whenever we sing our national anthem. And that statement means, number one, we live for freedom. Number two, we fight for freedom. So in each of the things we do in society, we should give effect to this. Now, if you look at section 25, that particular section, the purpose of the section is to, number one, protect private ownership of rights. Number two, advance public interest. In the main, the emphasis has been on protection of private rights. But I must emphasize that when you look at broadly the section, you may agree with me that what is more central to the section is the advancement of public interest. And for that, I rely on the case of FNB. It's a constitutional court judgment. But again, I should indicate that in September 1996, in the certification judgment, there was an objection before the adoption of the Constitution to the draft section as it then stood. And the Constitutional Court embarked on a study of the international instruments and foreign law. The conclusion of the Constitutional Court was that there is no country where there is absolute protection of the right to property. Now, what then happened was that the draft section became the certified section, meaning that the section as we have now has been canvassed fully in the Constitutional Court prior to the adoption of the Constitution. I have prepared a presentation. I will give you a copy. It shows specific paragraphs in the judgment, but also paragraphs in the body of the written presentation I made. So that the issue as to how the right to property is protected, is settled. It's protected in the negative, because subsection 1 of section 25 says, and I quote, "No one may be deprived of property except in terms of law of general application, and no law may permit arbitrary deprivation of property." What this subsection says, you can deprive property, including land. But what you must not do is to do so capriciously, must not do so arbitrarily. And further, you must do that in terms of the law of general application. So expropriation can or and is allowed. Further again, the judgment of the FNB showed that section 25 is not a mere protection of private property, but also to advance the public interest. I think I've touched this already. But again, a very important judgment is the judgment in the matter of Agri-Forum, Agri-SA. In summary, the relevant portions of the judgment, which is also in the body of the written submission, a summary of which I have made and will give to the chair of the session. The summary of that judgment says the state has a social responsibility, and that social responsibility ranks higher when compared with the protection of the right to property. That particular case recognizes the injustice of the past emphasizes that the Constitution is transformative in nature, and further, very importantly, which is what we are all interested in, it shows that the section opens opportunities for people. And then it goes on, the very case of AgriSA confirms a decision of FNB, in which case the Constitutional Court said it is possible, it appears, because it was not seized with expropriation, it is possible to expropriate without compensation. So there are two cases which have emphasized this point. But I think the diamond matter as well would be the third case, in which the Constitutional Court showed that expropriation without compensation, or not expropriation, it's deprivation, is allowed currently as we speak in the Constitution. Again, I need to show there's a difference between deprivation and expropriation. You possibly read the submissions. In summary, what deprivation means is that there must be use of the property, there must be interference with the use of the property, and that there's no compensation if you deprive land. Now, what does this mean? There was a case of short of water here in Cape Town. Parliament probably was also affected. What was required at that point, if the state was aware, was to go to that institution which released water to say, for the public interest, bring this water. It's allowed. Currently, as you speak, it has always been allowed. And there are judgments. FNB, there's Agri SA, there's also Diamond Matter. Now, the question then is, if there's no use, what then? You take the land. There's no concept currently in the country. We try to develop some concept. You see, there's paragraph 24. You take the land. If there's use of the land, but the interference is not substantial, remember, the requirement for deprivation is that the interference must be substantial. If it's less substantial, you go to paragraph 24 of our submission. It solves the problem. Let's take the land. Access to land. It can be read together with subsection 5 of the Constitution, together with as well subsection 6 of the Constitution. And there's a Grootboom judgment in which the Constitutional Court in 1999 showed that the state, of course, emphasizing a section in the Constitution, has an obligation to facilitate access to land. But interestingly and more importantly, in the very judgment, if there's an obligation, and this is the interpretation of the court, if there's an obligation, the corresponding right is that the person who should benefit from the obligation may demand the state to meet its obligation. Of course, we have never used that case law, and if we were to use it and the state fails, we can even compel it to act as it should. Now, I was doing these two things to show that separate from expropriation, currently, the state can access land for the benefit of the people. So I would recommend, because the law of general application already, the law of general application is the cases decided, which interpreted section 25, already permits deprivation and other forms of facilitation of access to land. I would recommend that, and it's not appearing in the submission, it's an afterthought when I was finalizing the book I'm busy with on the subject, that the state may be advised by this committee to develop regulations to regulate how the process should unfold. And the main reason is that if not regulated, it may be arbitrary, because people will decide in Limpopo, in Eastern Cape, how they do it. So if it's formalized and it's central, it can be easy. Now, the next question, and I must conclude on this one, is the subject of expropriation. I've shown that the deprivation and others are permissible, are allowed, permitted, not permissible, permitted already in the Constitution. But again, I should say that expropriation is permissible. We go to subsection 8 of section 25. You go to the High Panel Report, page 205. The panel report, without elaborating, indicates that I don't know why it did not elaborate, because they should have solved the problem. if you go to page 205, I think they noticed that this subsection allows limitation of the right to property. But again, any right in the Bill of Rights can be limited by straight application of Section 36, subsection 1. You go straight to that section, you limit the right in the Constitution. So it is allowed, it's permissible. Now the question may be, what then do we do? Do we amend, which is what I'm called upon to do, or do we not amend? My recommendation, I think it's on page 94 and 95. You can do these two things, and this is how they can be done. Amendments, and I know there are political organizations which have a strong view about this. Amendments would take a very long time. Remember I said the property clause was already certified in 1996. So if we implement that concretized clause, start now, facilitate access to land. If you amend, because the amendment is going to take long, you may, as you implement what you have, you know, in the process, amen.
Thank you, sir. The time has lapsed. Honourable members, clarity seeking questions. Members, Honourable Koranov.
Chair, thank you very much. It's a difficult document, but nevertheless, can I just ask you one thing? You say we should not amend because of it's going to take too long. So you suggest is that we proceed immediately with legislation in terms of the framework of the Constitution. Am I correct?
The first one, deprivation and access to land, there's no need for legislation. Regulate. Regulators in regulation, not an act of parliament. That's number one. But the motion in parliament is about expropriation. I am saying, if there's a need to amend, and I'm not saying there should not be an amendment, if there's need to amend, let's amend. But because amendment is going to take long, let's not start with that. Let's start with subsection 8 departure legislation, which could be finalized soon, because, and I should explain this, if you amend the Constitution, you must still come back and promulgate an act of parliament to give effect to the amended Constitution. So amendment of the Constitution is a two-way process. So it's just a matter of logic, but both of them in law allowed. But that because people want access down to the land, practically, in mathematics, what do you do? Solve the immediate problem and come to the other one later on.
Honorable Maila. Thanks, Chair. Brought by Honorable Shah S. Chivambo.
Mr. Chi, I'm not getting you very clear what you want us to. Should we amend the Constitution or should we not? Should we expropriate land without compensation or should we expropriate land with compensation?
No,
or there is the imbalances of the past.
Honourable Member, the resolution of Parliament says let's expropriate without compensation. So the debate is not about whether to or not with compensation. That the resolution says we expropriate without compensation is settled. To come to this committee and suggest that we should not expropriate without compensation is an indirect review of the decision of Parliament. So we should not allow that. But then, if we stick then to the motion in Parliament, ours should be to come here and say, given the motion, this is how we think we can do it. Now the question is, from what you're asking me, should we amend or not amend? I said, if we decide tomorrow the 17th, the 7th, to deprive and facilitate access, we can require the state to start the processes. But if we amend, it must still go to Parliament, be approved, legislation, the bill be drafted and all of those things to amend, and it's going to take long. So as we are amending at a later stage, we could be facilitating access currently. Sorry?
Appropriating in the meantime.
No, I try to differentiate between deprivation and expropriation. They are not the same. They are... Okay?
I have this difficulty. Maybe I'm getting you very slow. You say you are not against the resolution of Parliament of expropriating without compensation.
Correct.
So what you are saying is we can carry on.
Correct.
Expropriating.
Correct, yeah, correct. Correct.
But then at a later stage amend the Constitution.
Yeah, but maybe that's where the difficulty lies. There are two concepts clearly expressed in the Constitution: deprivation and expropriation. Deprivation, Agri-SA, FNB Meta, is it Diamond Meta? The three of them allow, they clarify that deprivation is allowed without compensation. Now, the question is, what's deprivation? I explained what is deprivation. So we can start with deprivation, but if the reason why I'm directing members of the committee to paragraph 24 is because that's where something which looks like expropriation is, but it's not expropriation.
All right. Thank you. Rishivambo?
Thanks, Chairperson. You know, you're saying so many things, Mr. Chidi, but we can't hear you. Like, when you say that amending the Constitution is going to take long, what is long? Because this process that we're engaged in is a deliberate process of consulting with our people, getting submissions, and then we then come with a quality and much more durable product out of this process. We pass laws here, sometimes the laws take 3 months, sometimes it takes 6 months, and sometimes it's maximum of 60 days in terms of what the process says, because section 74 of the Constitution outlines the process that we should follow to amend the Constitution, of tabling the Constitutional Review Bill, the Constitutional Amendment Bill, and then we must subject to public hearings for 30 days. What will be difficult about that? And don't take forever. And there is nothing wrong with, after amending the Constitution, if we then prescribe accompanying legislation to then engage in that process. Why do you come to Parliament to suggest shortcuts to us? We're not looking for shortcuts. We want to amend the Constitution. That is the intention of this process. That is why we're called the Constitutional Review Committee. If you wanted to suggest a different process, there are different people who are dealing with that. I think the ANC is trying to do that in Gauteng. They are saying they are taking the land now. Ourselves here were specifically and patiently dealing with the issue of constitutional amendment. And that is what we need guidance on, not some shortcut that says, no, just go ahead and do things. We're not doing that. It's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to amend the Constitution. And Section 74 guides us in terms of that process, and we'll be able to achieve that without shortcuts that we are proposing to ask.
Honourable Fultana, Honourable Lutelli is followed by Honourable Fultana.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thanks to the presenter. I believe it's very technical. That's why we are kind of struggling to understand it. But from what I hear, if I'm correct, because I want to be clear here, do you really, in simple terms, mean to say currently the Constitution provides for expropriation? It's a matter of how we go about achieving that. Or do you want to tell us that we can amend the Constitution, or the Constitution is current form, Section 25, is problematic in terms of achieving what we want to achieve? That's the clarity that we want you to assist on. If then you mean to say the
Section 25 in its current form can assist us, then this is the how part that you are proposing to us, then I think I would understand.
Honorable Fultana.
Thank you, Chair. Seeing that regulations have got to be in sync with as well as in congruence with the principal act while subservient to it at the same time, don't you foresee a situation where if Parliament passes the regulations, the simpler route and quicker one that you're suggesting, in the process of trying to implement those regulations, don't you foresee a situation whereby those could be challenged if people feel that they are not in sync with the Constitution per se? And then what we thought would have been a shorter method becomes a protracted legal process. Thank you.
Mr. Chidi?
Maybe the last one. Of course, it would be the executive which passes the regulations. But if those regulations were to be challenged, there are three cases which have already clarified that point. The FNB matter, AgriSA matter, and the diamond matter. I'm not sure about the diamond matter. And these three matters have shown already that the state currently is permitted constitutionally to deprive land. Following that, as per paragraph 24, to facilitate access. So I'm not really proposing shortcuts here. I'm saying let's implement what we have. Well, of course, some may see them as shortcuts, but it's not a shortcut. I mean, you have it, why don't you implement it? That's part number one. It has nothing to do with expropriation, that process. Now, the expropriation part, when we deal with that, and this is my understanding, the mandate of this committee is to review, not to amend, Section 25. So in reviewing Section 25, we consider whether it's appropriate to give effect to land reform or not. And my proposal in that respect is that the Parliament can start, as for expropriation, with a process to facilitate expropriation without compensation. And at a later stage, or concurrently with the process to come up with the Act, also propose the amendment. But I foresee the amendment being controversial. I think my good sir asked on Tuesday whether the amendment should be subjected to the certification process on Tuesday, which is open to debate. So it may be lengthy, but of course I'm called upon to give advice. I will never decide for Parliament. A lawyer never decides for anyone. I'm not sure whether I answered all the questions because they seem to be interrelated.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm sorry to say that the more you try to explain yourself, the deeper we're thrown into trouble. Honestly, thank you very much for your contribution.
It's regrettable that people that come and make a submission that doesn't suit a certain narrative are being criticized. We should allow them to make their submission and ask questions of clarity.
Point of order,
Chair. Your ruling, Chair.
Point of order, Chair. Point of order, Chair.
No, no. Let me hear Honorable Swart, members.
Point of order, Chair.
Yeah, I'll take the point. Let him conclude.
That was in relation to the statement that was made. Why do you come to Parliament and tell us to shortcut the process? We're not doing that. We are amending the Constitution. We've taken no decision as a committee yet. Certain people might hold a view, but at this stage we are listening with respect to each submission. And I would ask the presenter, I would just like to thank the presenter for a very lengthy legal document. It's a very lengthy document and we received it this morning. And just on paragraph 188, which you make it very clear, no amendment, that section 25(2) and all the provisions relevant to compensation be left as are. That's your proposition. Do you agree with that?
Point of order, sir?
Yeah. Honourable Tana?
Thank you very much, sir. The reason I made that comment, sir, just to in response to what Honourable Swartz is saying, was because I am not getting a direct answer to my question. As much as I've got a perspective here politically, but I'm not getting a direct answer from him. That's all. I've got no problem about people who have got different views to mine on this matter. I can argue my case in any forum and be successful too.
Yeah, thank you. Honourable Tana, the clarity is a misled one. You're clarifying that you were supposed to seek clarity from Mr. Chidi, not from Mr. Swart. All right. Honourable Mpuru.
No, thank you, Chair. We are just exercising one of our responsibilities, which is public participation. But that cannot override what Parliament is supposed to do. We are different political parties here. We still have our own mandates at the end of the day to come to a resolution. But that doesn't mean that as a sector, you mustn't be directive in what you want to present to us, because indeed you are more technical than giving us what you are supposed to give us. It was just a comment, not a question. Thank you.
Yeah, no, the point of explanation is out of order, Honorable Mpuru. And then, Honorable Shivambu?
No, my biggest worry and concern is that the learned friend traveled from Pretoria to come here to say nothing. Can we give him an opportunity for the last time to summarize in one sentence what his submission is, so that we've got some clarity of what his submission is. Just one sentence.
Yeah. No, Honorable Chidi, Mr. Chidi, we've run out of time for this slot, so you would just in conclusion cover everything you want to cover.
The actual recommendation appears as for amendment on page 95, paragraph E. And I'm saying if it is deemed necessary, I don't want to impose my view, if it's deemed necessary, you may proceed to amend. And that is what I said. But maybe I should indicate, maybe the document was too technical, as you said. But the purpose of the submission was simply that what we have, which is implementable, can be implemented. And number two, a law of general application in terms of section 25 subsection 8 to depart from the requirement of compensation and exclude compensation. And or alternatively, to amend the constitution. But if it's not clear, it's unfortunate. It will come clear in the book that I'm releasing next week. It will become clear.
Mr. Chidi, from Chidi Attendees, we really thank you for the presentation. It has enriched the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've also marketed the book. I hope members will buy it.
Thank you.
All right. The next presenter is the South African Human Rights Commission, SAHRC, and I'm informed that Mr. J.P. Spanion is the presenter on behalf of the SAHRC. Please get ready, sir. As you're ready, we are ready.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and members of the Constitutional Review Committee, and Honourable Members of Parliament. First of all, I would like to indicate that I am a Commissioner of the Human Rights Commission. My focus area is land, farming communities, and environment. I am accompanied today by Commissioner Andre Gam, as well as our Senior Research Counselor, Dr. Chanel Vandenberg, and our parliamentary liaison officer, Fadler Adams. I would like to first of all say that we appreciate the opportunity of being invited to come and make this oral presentation, and also to indicate that as the South African Human Rights Commission, we are the guardian of human rights and constitutional democracy in South Africa. And then that's why we wished to avail ourselves of using this opportunity to make the presentation. We have made a PowerPoint presentation, but I will talk to it, Mr. Chairperson, with your permission. Our PowerPoint presentation consists of the following contents: the Human Rights Commission's mandate, and secondly, the human rights position on land reform, and thirdly, the investigative inquiry, and after the findings, it also deals with the position on expropriation and the proposed amendment. And I will have at the end the concluding remarks.
To be it's only 10 minutes, Mr. Sibanye, right? So you will fit that in 10 minutes.
I will fit that in 10 minutes. I will skip some of the PowerPoints, namely insofar as the mandate of the Human Rights Commission is concerned. We are talking to you as the organs of state. I won't deal much in detail. I take it that the legislature knows what is the Human Rights Commission, state institution supporting constitutional democracy. But having said that, I would like to emphasize our mandate that apart from the Chapter 9 in the Constitution, the other leg is the South African Human Rights Commission Act of 2013. And specifically, I will quote Section 13, subsection 2, A and B. Subsection A says this, I quote, "The Commission may recommend to Parliament or any other legislature the adoption of new legislation which will promote respect for human rights and a culture of human rights." And number B says, I quote, "If the Commission is of the opinion that any proposed legislation might be contrary to Chapter 2 of the Constitution or to norms of international human rights law, which form part of the South African law, or to other relevant norms of international law, it must immediately report that fact to the relevant legislature." That is why we are here, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I am now going quickly to slide number 5, which talks about the position of the Human Rights Commission on land reform. First of all, I would like to say land is dignity, and the restitution of land rights equals the restoration of dignity. And also to mention that the use of the 1998 restitution on claim deadline has been identified as a concern, but also other challenges that have made the resolution of the existing claims difficult and or severely delayed. Mr. Chairperson, I'm now on slide number 6 to emphasize that any such process must be transparent. It must include a plan for implementation which includes specific departmental obligations and clear timelines, and incorporate mechanisms that enable the public and Parliament to measure delivery and hold the executive directly accountable. And then slide number 7, Chairperson, on investigative inquiry. I want to say the Human Rights Commission held an inquiry in 2013, as well as another inquiry this year, 2018, during March. And then to mention that as the Human Rights Commission, we are saying a fundamental solution to address the issue of land reform is the adoption of reasonable legislative and policy measures that can be used by government to facilitate and expedite land reform as required by Section 25, subsection 8 of the Constitution. I would quote that section 25, subsection 8, but I want to say the Commission regards the ineffective implementation of land reform programs as the root cause of inadequate land reform in South Africa. And given the decreasing budget for land reform, as well as failure of the willing buyer, willing seller model used by the government to date, the Commission regards expropriation of land without compensation as being just and equitable in appropriate circumstances. May I remind you, honorable members, that the willing buyer and willing seller model is not part of the Constitution. Chairperson, further, the Human Rights Commission would like to indicate that in our 2018 public inquiry, we have made some findings. They are contained in the written submission that we have made. I will not delve into it now. And also, the Constitutional Review Committee is aware of the high-level panel that has been established and made some findings. The position of expropriation and our proposed amendment is that Section 25, subsection 8, explicitly authorizes a departure from the provisions in Section 25 to effect land reform that redresses the effect of racial discrimination, as long as a departure is in accordance with Section 36 of the Constitution, the limitation clause, Chairperson and honorable members. And we are saying that the conditions set by Section 25, subsection 8, read with Section 36(1), thus reflect the scope of government's proposed strategy of expropriating without compensation, in that it permits a departure from the compensation provisions in Section 25 to the land reform context. As I'm moving towards the end, Chairperson, of my presentation, I would like to point out that first legislative measures should acknowledge groups that were dispossessed of land prior to 1913 and whose position is thus not addressed by the restitutionary provisions enshrined in Section 25, subsection 7 of the Constitution. This group of beneficiaries would include both the Khoi and the Sen as a distinct group and ethnic tribal minorities dispossessed of land before the introduction of the Native Land Act of 1913 and the Native Affairs Land of 1920. This is no way should be taken as an exhaustive list, a numerous clause. And Chairperson, also the Human Rights Commission would like to emphasize that next, women should benefit from land redistribution, because in some other areas there are some voices to say women are not given an opportunity to access land. I want to emphasize the question of post-settlement support, that it should be revised to cater for long delays in current mentorship schemes. And then also to say, finally, Chairperson, the state should provide necessary infrastructure that is appropriate for the nature of land, albeit urban or rural. And lastly, Chairperson, there are concerns over the election to accept monetary compensation as opposed to land. We are saying this process should be a land claim, not a money claim. Therefore, to redress the racial impractices of the past, people should be advised to say, so as to redress the injustices of the past, which was land dispossession, if you want land restoration, people should opt for land claim and not monetary claim.
Thank you, Commissioner. Time is lapsed. Honourable members, clarity seeking questions. Honourable Kuranov. Honourable Jivambo. Right, let's start.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for the two gentlemen. I must declare I know them both, and I served with them in this parliament, and with the one commissioner I served in the Judicial Services Commission for many years. So welcome back in parliament, gentlemen. On section 25.3 lists five criteria to be considered when you determine compensation when it will be just and equitable. I want to know from the Commission, do you think it is an exhaustive list, or do you think we can add to that list? Second question, Chair, is that we all know that Section 25.3 has never been tested in the Constitutional Court. It went to the one court, and the Supreme Court then reversed the lower court, but it never went to the Constitutional Court. I want to know whether the Human Rights Commission have the authority to petition the Con Court to pronounce on Section 25.3. And if you do have that authority, are you contemplating to do it? Norish Wabo.
Thank
thanks, Chair. I'm not comfortable with the Human Rights Commission's position. I think they're taking a political posture which is problematic. And I think for the same reason that we had said that government departments should not come to make presentations there. I think we should have forbade these institutions to come and make political statements here. And there's confusion as well, because they're speaking about land claimants and restitution, but not dealing with that now. There's a marked difference between the holding of piece by piece land claims and saying, no, I want this portion, it must be given back to me. I was talking about amendment of the Chapter 2, which your role is to ensure compliance with by all South Africans. We're not dealing with a separate legislation, we're dealing with the constitution that says that how do we consider a process of making a democratically elected government to be custodian of all South Africa's land and redistribute it equitably to all South Africans. I think you're overstretching your mandate in terms of even that section that you have read of the Human Rights Commission Act. You're reading it out of context deliberately because you want to make a political statement which is reactionary and problematic. I honestly think you must stay on your lane and deal with compliance with Chapter 2 of the Constitution by all South Africans in terms of the Bill of Rights and all of those issues there, and then allow Parliament to change the components which we think arise and must be dealt with differently. Of course, you're members of Parliament before, you're no longer members of Parliament now. You must accept that and then deal with what you've been mandated to deal with. Thank you very much.
Today you woke up on the other side of the bed. You're not seeking any clarities on some of these issues. You're making statements, continuous statements for the whole day. Please, let's be in line with what we are doing. If there are no clarity seeking questions, let's leave it. All right, Honorable Fultana.
Thank you, sir.
Followed by Honorable Swart.
I hope I woke up on the right side of the bed. Well, thanks very much for the presentation. It's quite challenging intellectually. You, in page 7, you talk of systemic interventions, and then later, although not put so succinctly, you were, in a way,
suggest that there could have been even systematic, you know, were problems in the process. Just as a preamble to my question, Chair, currently there is no law of general application. You probably would be aware of the latest developments regarding that attempt by Public Works, where this expropriation has been put to ice for now, on the basis of the fact that we are busy with this process here in the CRC. So, therefore, Parliament and government generally is left with no option really when it comes to expropriating without compensation. I know that there was no provision for expropriating without compensation in that. But be that as it may, if you look at what you see in page 8, or slide 8, the second bullet point, where you say the Constitution does not lend itself to amendments in the detail needed to limit expropriation without compensation. Take that vis-a-vis what you state in paragraphs in pages 9, where you say the Commission regards expropriation of land without compensation as being just and equitable in appropriate circumstances. Same or similar sentiment is expressed in slides 13 and 14, where you seem to be conditionally supporting, you know, expropriation without without compensation. Now, this leaves us in a situation where we do not quite, let me say I, do not quite know whether you are for or against. As I said, Chair, we seek, this is a clarity-seeking question here. I've put paragraph 8, and I've juxtaposed it with 9, 13, and 14. There seems to be circumstantial support, you know, where for amendments of Section 25. How should we actually understand you? Thank you. Because the just and equitable is exactly what you stated in paragraphs in subsection 3. There's nothing new. You've just rewritten it as it were the just and equitable thing, you know, condition. So I'm trying to understand exactly where you suggest we should go as this committee, particularly in the context of what Honorable Shivambe has said. Thank you.
Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair. May I firstly just express my deepest sympathy on the death of your son, Honorable Sibonyani. It was some time ago, but we do express our and welcome both you as a former Member of Parliament and former Advocate Gaum as also a former Member of Parliament. The SA Human Rights Commission is a Chapter 9 institution which promotes respect for human rights and a culture of human rights, including Section 25. Now on page 13, you make it very clear what your position is, and it is in line with those expressed by the academics. Other lawyers differed from that position, they're entitled to, but you say, the conditions set by Section 25(8) read with Section 36(1) thus reflect the scope of government's proposed strategy of expropriation without compensation, in that it permits a departure from compensation provisions in Section 25 to the land reform context. So would you agree that that makes it very clear that you're saying that the Constitution as presently worded allows expropriation without compensation? Thank you, Chair.
Commissioners? Sorry, let's just take one room table.
I was saying, Chairperson, this presentation is so contradictory. When you go to page 21, bullet number 3, which reads, beneficiaries should be prioritized based on need and should include those dispossessed of land prior to 1930, women, youth, and people with disability. This relates to specifically to Section 25, subsection 7, which is contradictory to what you are saying here. Because you know that section is talking about people who have been dispossessed on or before on or after 1913 Land Act. Now how, especially in reference to this bullet number 3, and what you have stated in previous slides, how then do you reconcile this bullet number 3 with what is stated in terms of section 25 subsection 7? Because this really appears contradictory. So please clarify that.
Honorable, Commissioner Sibanyoni.
I will allow Commissioner Advocate come to go first. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll deal with a couple of issues and Commissioner Sibanyoni with some of the others. Honorable Kurunov asked about the exhaustive list matter in section 25.3. Well, clearly it is not an exhaustive list, as there is reference to including, and then it lists the particular issues that need to be taken, the factors that need to be taken into account. So it's not an exhaustive list. I think the crux of what we are saying is indeed that in terms of section 25.8, it does allow a departure from the provisions of section 25, 2 and 3 pertaining to the matter of compensation. It does allow for legislation to depart from that as long as it is in line with the limitations clause, section 36 of our constitution, and that is our clear position, which is a very clear position that expropriation without compensation is indeed allowed, but it should rather be through legislation than through amending the constitution, because of the two points that we make in that regard. And that is the first point is that the constitution doesn't really allow the or lend itself to the detail required in this regard, because there can't be an unlimited expropriation without compensation. It needs to be, the detail needs to be provided, and the best way of dealing with that and providing for that detail is through legislation. And then the second point we are making is that there is the well-established principle of constitutional subsidiarity, which states that in the first instance reliance should be placed on legislation in terms of specific rights in the Bill of Rights, and not on the rights themselves, but on legislation that gives detail, that gives, which basically gives detail about how exactly it should take place, what would be the conditions for that, and so on. And therefore, we are advising, as we have to do, we have the duty to do that in terms of section 13 of the South African Human Rights Commission Act, that it might be even flying against the principle of constitutional subsidiarity if the legislative route is not taken, but the constitution is instead amended. In terms of the question whether we would be in a position to approach the Constitutional Court with regard to the provisions of Section 25.3 and how it should be interpreted, obviously we will have to still survive the test that it should be in the interest of justice to do that. And I'm not sure whether the Constitutional Court will allow us to do that in a vacuum. Constitutional Court would most probably say, you know, the route to go is that there should be legislation that can then be tested and interpreted in terms of Section 25 of the Constitution. And I understand that government is also planning certain test cases and so on in the Constitutional Court.
that is based on specific facts and specific circumstances and not being done in a sort of a vacuum, and I think that that should rather be the approach. And if there is such a matter of that nature that is brought to us, we might be in a position to assist and also go to court as far as that is concerned. We are specifically mandated in terms of our act to approach courts of law whenever that might be needed. Just the one other point that I wanted to clarify is to say that, yes, the point was made that isn't this now the only route, because there is no law of general application at the moment. And I think that exactly is the problem, that maybe Parliament should first make sure that there is a law of general application that can then be interpreted and tested in terms of the Constitution, if necessary, but that makes provision for expropriation without compensation. We are in favor of expropriation without compensation under certain specific circumstances, and in our longer document that we have presented to the committee, you will see exactly under which circumstances we would think expropriation without compensation would indeed be appropriate. All we are saying is that the Constitution absolutely allows this Parliament to do this by means of a law, legislation of general application, and we are recommending that that is the possibly the preferred way to go. And just in answering the Honourable Shivambu, I think it is very clear from what Commissioner Sibanyori read earlier in terms of Section 13 of the South African Human Rights Commission Act, that this is exactly we absolutely within our mandate. We are, in terms of the Constitution and our legislation, the custodians of the Bill of Rights. This is about a right in the Bill of Rights, and we are giving our best possible advice to Parliament in that regard, as we are not only mandated but required to do in terms of our act.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Maybe just to start by saying thank you, Mr. Swart, for the condolences to the Sibanyoni family, and it goes to the whole family. I omitted to mention that In our presence here, I've got my daughter, who's a student at UWC, sitting there at the back. Can you wave your hand there? Boom, I named after my father, after my mother. She's Rosalie. You are spot on, Mr. Swart, to say it is very clear. And then also to emphasize the fact that we, as the Human Rights Commission, We operate in terms of the Constitution. We also operate in terms of this enabling legislation, the Human Rights the South African Human Rights Commission Act. And then because we've got a mandate, and then that mandate we need to do it, exercise it without fear, without favor, without prejudice, without bias. And then we always stay within the enabling legislation. I want to emphasize that. We are an independent institution, human rights institution. Thank you.
We extend our thanks to USAHC for enriching the process and participating in this public process of the CRC. Thank you very much, and good to see you, our old friends, in you. Thank you very much.
thank you for the opportunity, Chairperson and honorable members and members of the Constitutional Review Committee.
Thank you very much. And interestingly enough, I think both of us have been members of this committee before.
Yeah. All right. All right, our next presenter is Helen Suzman, Foundation, and Mr. Anton van Dalfa, if you're ready, we are ready.
I think, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my director would just like to say one or two words before I start.
Okay, director.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the committee for allowing us the opportunity to present our thoughts, reflections, and views on this process. There seem to be two issues here. Firstly, a constitutional amendment concerning Section 25, in order, secondly, to give effect to expropriation without compensation in order to address historic and other legacies of dispossession. On the constitutional amendments, just two points that perhaps could guide us. Are we certain it is desirable? And secondly, are we certain it is necessary? I think that the HSF would reply that no in both instances. Our constitution is both an exalted document which has been praised both nationally and internationally. It's also a framework for the progressive realization of rights. On this question of land and by implication Section 25, we take our position from the high-level panel chaired by former President Motlanthe, where also the due process and the rule of law are our guiding rights. I'd like now to call on my colleagues, first Anton van Dalsem, to present on Section 25. Thereafter, I'd like to call on Charles Simpkins to explore the issues surrounding urban land, which we believe is an integral part to any discussion on land use. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think, first of all, let us have a look at what has happened over the last 20 years on the subject of land reform. And we see that the process of restitution has been extremely slow. At the current rate, it will take more than 30 years to finalize the claims that were lodged before 1998. Secondly, a minimal budget has been allocated to land reform. It represents about 0.3% of the government's budget. No attempt has been made by government to use Section 25 to expedite land reform. There's a failure to amend the Expropriation Act, which dates back to 1975, which contains the willing buyer, willing seller provision, which does not appear in the Constitution. And other stumbling blocks have been corruption, diversion to elites, a lack of political will, and inadequate institutional capacity of government authorities. And all of these are detailed in the high-level panel report. Now, you will note that none of the obstacles that I have mentioned include problems with the Constitution. And in particular, the public debate so far has made surprisingly little reference to Section 25(8), which provides that Section 25 may not impede the state from taking measures to achieve land reform in order to redress the results of past racial discrimination. The focus of the public debate so far has been on whether the Constitution needs to be changed. But no attention has been paid so far to some of the questions that have to be answered by a land reform program. And some of these questions are the following. How are the decisions going to be taken? What are the relevant criteria? Who are to be the beneficiaries? How will land be identified? Are we talking of rural or urban land? Will there be post-settlement support? What dispute resolution mechanism is to be put in place? How will transparency be ensured? What legal title will beneficiaries be given? And will the relevant state agency have adequate staff and resources? Now, the Constitution cannot deal with all these issues. It cannot deal with the detailed legislative and administrative framework that a land reform policy requires. This has to be done by legislation which establishes a structure and a process that is generally perceived to be legitimate and not subject to arbitrary action. A properly resourced and funded government program is needed to manage the process. And a failure to do all these things will result in a process grinding to a halt through administrative incapacity, legal challenges, and corruption. As far as traditional areas are concerned, they cannot be ignored, as 3/4 of the rural population live in traditional areas. But clarity is needed, for example, on the content of land rights for households in urban settlements within traditional areas, to provide certainty in respect of ownership of land on which houses are built, for instance. Paragraph 10b of the motion establishing the committee requests the committee to propose the necessary constitutional amendments, where applicable, with regard to the kind of future land tenure regime needed. But reforming land tenure in traditional areas can be dealt with by legislation to enable land reform to result in real ownership rights. And again, the Constitution does not need to be changed to enable this. Further point is that land reform is most needed in urban areas, since urbanization is much more advanced than generally recognized. Including urbanization in traditional areas, 84% of South Africa is effectively urbanized. And whereas the public debate is concentrated on rural land, reform policies in urban areas can affect many more people. The focus must be on the poorest and most marginalized segments of the population. Expropriation without compensation cannot be justified if the beneficiaries come from the wealthier sections of society. If this happens, the position of the poor would worsen and political dissatisfaction will increase. And as a conclusion, land reform is imperative not only as a result of South Africa's history of dispossession, but also to address the issue of wealth inequality. However, the focus on changing the Constitution to address these challenges is misplaced and unhelpful. A clearly defined legislative and administrative framework has to be established, with detailed decision-making criteria run by a properly funded and staffed government agency. And this is absolutely crucial. Unless this is done, the process will be derailed by inefficiency, corruption, elite capture, and stalled by litigation. And in addition to the harm done to land reform, this will have a negative effect on the economy, it will damage business confidence, and will undermine the constitutional basis of our democracy. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the Foundation, Helen Suzman Foundation. Honourable members, it's your turn. Oh, yeah.
Do we still have a bit of time
to
present?
We still have time. I'm keeping it.
You are 3 minutes.
My colleague, Charles Simpkins, will now talk about the issue around urban land.
Okay. 3 minutes.
When considering what to do about the land question, one really has to have an accurate shape of the problems and challenges we face. Now, urban and rural land reform are both important, but they are different, require different approaches. And what we're saying is South African urbanization is much more advanced than is generally recognized. The reason is that there's no distinction in Statistics South Africa's figures between urban and rural areas within traditional areas. 94% of the country outside traditional areas is urbanized, but we believe between 60 and 65% of population in traditional areas lives in urban settlements, either formal urban settlements or dense settlements like informal urban settlements outside traditional areas. So the urban pressure is very great, and the events will be particularly unfold in the metropolitan areas, which are growing faster than any other set of areas in the country. So we have a situation where more than 80% of the population live in urban areas and nearly 90% of the household income is earned there. We also have a situation in which we expect the number of households in metropolitan areas in 2030 to be 70% higher than it was in 2011. So the pressure is strong and it's unremitting and demands a clear urban response. And to do that, you really have to assemble land in the metropolitan areas, and particularly the 5 big ones in particular, as well as promote densification of urban settlement within those areas. And we think this is very urgent. We think that unless it's attended to in short order, we're going to have land invasions and suboptimal settlement in the metropolitan areas. So we would draw to your attention the particular importance of getting ahead of the curve in the metros. Thank you.
A concluding director? All right, thank you very much. Honourable members, it's your turn. Clarity seeking questions. Honourable Mampuru, Honourable Mutapo, Honourable Chivambu. All right, let's go.
Oh, thank you, Chair. On page 9, bullet number 4, I just want clarity there. It says, unless this is done, the process will be derailed by inefficiency, corruption, and let capture and stalled by litigation as it continues. I just want to be clear, what do you mean by this?
I think what is meant there is that subordinate legislation, so it's not the constitution, but legislation has to be passed giving a detailed framework within which the whole land reform process can run. And this would be legislation and subordinate regulations. These need to be detailed enough to indicate to whichever agency is going to run the process how decisions are to be taken, who is to benefit from the process, and how the whole process is going to run. And in particular, it has to avoid the danger of allowing arbitrary decisions to be taken. So there has to be a very clear framework or criteria framework that has to be used. And if this detailed framework, and not to be forgotten, there has to be a properly staffed and resourced government department to run this. So if you don't have the legislation in place to deal with the framework, and you don't have an efficient and properly staffed government department to run it, then the effects which I've mentioned will follow.
Tabo?
Thank you, Chair. You spent more than 90% of your time focusing on communal land, which is rocky, mountainous, barren, and so forth. Why, in your presentation, did you leave the affluent, fertile, and the land, which is the one which has been mostly affected by this land dispossession?
When you answer, must we take more? All right, let's answer that one.
I don't think that we focus purely on the infertile land. Maybe the question could be expanded to make it clearer, but I don't think we're focusing on the infertile portions of the land. Not at all, unless I misunderstood your question.
Yes, Honourable Tabo.
You did say, on your presentation, most of your, especially with your respect, most of your presentation focus on tribal land. Yes. My question is based on that. You spend much. If you shake your head, then I'm going to shake mine when you respond. Because, yes. So most of your presentation, you focus on tribal land. That's why I'm commenting based on that. And your neighbor here on the left-hand side, your left-hand side, also did the same.
Let me answer that.
I think there's a figure of 84%. Where she's asking a question, it's based on that paragraph, yeah. That 84%.
In my presentation, I said that traditional areas cannot be ignored. So I'm not purely focusing on that. I'm just, in as far as traditional areas are concerned, it has to be attended to. It's not that is the sole importance, but the importance is that including urbanization in traditional areas. Effectively, 84% of South Africa is urbanized. And I think the point needs to be made there that the public debate so far has concentrated, for one reason or another, on farming land, on rural land. but we are actively looking at 84% of South Africa which is urbanized. So what we're saying is that the focus should actually move from the rural areas to what is effectively an urbanized population, where there are specific requirements and needs that need to be met.
Thanks, Chair. I want this Ellen Sussman Foundation to explain this wild allegation and supposition that they are making here, that expropriation without compensation cannot be justified if the beneficiaries come from the wealthier sections of society. If this happens, the position of the poor will worsen and political disaffection will increase. I would need a clearer context. And quickly, Chair, they keep on making reference as well to the high-level panel report of which was chaired by former President Helmer Motlanthe. One is that report was not sanctioned by Parliament. It has never been adopted by Parliament. It doesn't have any official status. It's an opinion of people, like your opinion. It has got no status. It was the Speaker's issue, which has got nothing to do with official parliamentary resolutions. So it has got no status in terms of what should happen. But also, aren't you suggesting that we must keep the status quo in terms of land ownership, which is predominantly white because of colonial dispossession, because of apartheid, which Helen Sussman participated in and legitimated by being part of the apartheid parliament? Aren't you suggesting...
Point of order, Chair.
Sierra, point of order.
No, Honourable Member, you're not supposed to wait for him to finish with the point of order, and you know that.
Let's hear the point of order.
Fundamentally clear that Helen Sussman spent her entire life fighting against the apartheid system. And what Mr. Shibamba has just said is patently untrue.
All right. It's a point of debate now.
Yeah, it's a point of debate, Chair.
Yeah. No, please.
Even the objection is not correct because Helen Sussman was an apartheid collaborationist who even campaigned for the increase of social grants for whites. White supremacists who were not shocked even by the position of the Helen Sussman Foundation, because she was a reactionary who pretended to be against apartheid. The question is, are you saying we should maintain the apartheid property relations where the white minority are in ownership and control of the land at expense of the black indigenous populations who are dispossessed through violence, through murder, through rape, through all sorts of harassment that got to violently remove our people from the land? Are you saying that we must just keep the status quo? And if not, what else do we do except removing a stumbling block that says that if we're to take back the land, there must be payments, there must be amounts, because the Constitution mentions payment. The Constitution mentions amounts. I say we must leave that, we must not do anything about the Constitution. Is that what you come and say, you left wherever you came from, to come and present here, that we must leave the status quo in terms of the Constitution? Three old white men who benefited under apartheid coming here to say that we must not change the Constitution.
It's not acceptable.
You're going to have some control of this meeting at some point.
Honorable Shivambu, please, let's treat our fellow citizens with respect and dignity. Helen Sussman, whatever their views they represent, they are legitimate, they are here within the rights that are accorded to them. So we can't attack them for being here and for expressing whatever they view and representing whatever the values they represent. So please refrain, and I've been asking you today to refrain. It's wrong. Helen Sussman, please answer.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that you're aware that the honourable member here next to me is just ignoring you.
Who?
She carries on her own conversation. She doesn't listen to anything you say when you make a ruling, and she just carries on waffling on in her own. Could you start over this meeting?
What's your problem, when?
Honorable Shibambu, please treat this process with integrity.
Mr. Chairman, as the meeting is beginning to get out of order in a way which is, from my point of view, at least as the director, unacceptable, may I ask you to adjourn the meeting for 5 minutes? I'm aware that blood sugar levels may be causing this, until the members of your committee have calmed down. Would you consider that, please, Mr. Chairman?
No. Honorable Shivambu, please help us. And please refrain, members, to do this. The issue is that you went beyond the scope of the committee, and that's out of order.
I'm really sorry.
No, but you have to respect the process and treat the process with integrity. You as an honorable member, and don't attack the presenters, and don't go beyond the scope that the committee has agreed upon. That's the principle.
Chairperson, I'm really sorry.
Yes, Honorable Carter.
Yeah. Jay, I really think for a member to stand here and tell another member that I'm going to, and I'm sorry I'm quoting, blixam you, is really not the thing to do. I really think that the member should leave this committee. This is just not acceptable.
I'll be happy to leave the committee, Mr. Chair.
Sorry? Who was that? All right, no, members, please, let's continue. I mean, you can't conduct yourselves like this. Members, you can't conduct yourselves like that. You are even asked by the guest to go and cool off.
Chairperson, yes? Just quickly on the point of order. So, this member from the phasing out organization called COOP says that she's calling a point of order because someone said a black cell, and then she thought it is the member.
No, I think she meant white cell.
And then what happened is then the person who said black cell owns up that it's her who said it, but immediately she withdraws that because it's a white person who said it. But when it's a black person, she was saying you must remove that person from the committee. Like it's one of the issues that we're dealing with here.
Members, I don't understand what are you all dealing about. The position of Helen Suzman Foundation is before you. If you need clarity, ask clarity there. Whatever you are trying to do, you will have your opportunity at a particular time. Why you raise your blood sugar? Really, why? I don't understand it. You can't change anybody here. You have no power to do that. Helen Suzman, please reply if there's anything to reply.
Chair, there's quite a lot to reply. I presume that this sort of altercation, which members of Parliament are probably used to, but which don't happen out there in the real world, are not going to impact on the time which we have in order to present, discuss, and deliberate. So I will presume that that is will indicate our position. Firstly, on the question of the high-level panel, of course it's not a parliamentary committee. Members of Parliament may not presume that people outside of Parliament suffer from a severe lack of intelligence. We can read, we understand what it is. It's a policy document. We are a research institution in the first order. We look at a wide variety of research in arriving at a decision. And in terms of the research for that particular chapter, perhaps one of the most informed researchers, Anika Clausen, had a major and a significant role. Anika Clausen has a long history of land, and I would like to say that is why we looked at it, because it's a very comprehensive view of the issue. Secondly, and I must address this, and this will not come out of our time, I trust, Mr. Chairman, on the question of Helen Suzman. I find that the remarks about her being a reactionary and so on and so forth, deeply objectionable.
Point of order, Chair. Point of order, Chair, please.
Honourable Dan.
Thank you.
No.
May I humbly appeal to the Speaker, through you, to stop making constant references to what is happening on this side of the... That's beyond his scope. He must just stick to the subject matter.
No.
If it's done, out of parliament.
No, no.
Thank you.
Honorable Fultan, you know that you first don't throw stones if you're living in a glasshouse. So, because they have a right to reply. They can't go when a record... You see, when you speak here, you speak on a record. Somebody speaks on a record and they go without correcting the record. It cannot be acceptable. So don't
can't keep on correcting us.
No, no. When you say things beyond your scope, when you invite them on a particular scope, you go beyond the scope, then they have a right to reply. It's just common sense.
Allow them, Chair, to defend the reactionary apartheid collaborationist called
the
participated in apartheid parliament.
No, no.
Allow them, please.
You can regulate our behavior here. You don't.
No. They don't, but you are also regulated in terms of how you conduct yourselves and express yourself. All right. Honorable, continue, Director.
Thank you very much. I was asked to respond to four different issues, the second one being Helen Sussman, and I'm responding to it. I reject that out of hand. I cannot be responsible for other people's lack of a history. Thirdly, the question of dispossession from both as a result of colonialism is a widespread history. The obvious people in terms of the imperial and the colonial and later on the apartheid projects are black people, not only black people, Indians, coloureds as well. Later on, even Jews, believe it or not, and others, such as Middle Easterners, are all dispossessed. So this question of dispossession and colonialism is important. We've got to address this for all South Africans, and that is our plea, that dispossession is a complex social issue. How do we address it? My colleagues have said changing the constitution is not going to address it. There is already existing framework to address it. My colleague had spoken about the failure, as Ruth Hall said the other day in this very chamber. We're asking the wrong questions. It's not about changing the constitution. It's about why hasn't government for the last quarter of a century addressed that question. I'm quoting her. And on the question finally, and I was dismayed that it came up, about three white old men. The operative word here is not white. I'm so pleased now I've been reclassified in terms of the Population Registration Act. I'm delighted, or not, as the case may be. I would say the operative word is old. The Helen Sussman Foundation, like all NGOs, is constrained. We are all retired men, and that's why we take this job up. Because we're passionate about this country, we are passionate about justice, and we are passionate about fairness. Thank you.
Honorable Sultana, Honorable Kata, Honorable Maila, Honorable Korenov, Honorable Pumla.
Thank you very much, Chair. You made a statement in your presentation that land reform is most needed in urban areas. I captured that. And that focus must be on the poor. No need to amend the constitution. Now, but then you proceed to say, if the constitution is amended, business confidence will nosedive. Now, we had this rhetoric a couple of times in parliament as well as outside of parliament. Now, currently, the number of people who are getting poor in South Africa is increasing long before there was talk of amending the constitution. And you say if the constitution is amended, things will go worse. To me, this sounds a rather insensitive and a self-selfish assertion that if the constitution is amended to give more land to more people who are poor. You sound contradictory. You come out like you favor the poor, but at the same time you say, should the constitution be amended so that the poor can access land, then the economy will help. The current economy is not helping the poor people of South Africa. That you know, probably more than I do.
And with this move in Parliament, we are creating a platform for the poor to access land so that they can also do something of their own and not be dependent on an economy which is irrelevant to them, as was the case in the olden days. Your reaction?
I think the focus clearly has to be, and this is what I tried to explain, legislation has to be passed by Parliament to set up a framework within which land reform can be implemented. And that framework has to set out very detailed rules which exclude arbitrary action. It has to make provision for an efficient and properly run government department to run the process, and the whole thing has to be properly funded. That's quite apart from what the Constitution says. Unless you have a legislative framework within which land reform can happen, the thing will end up in chaos. And that is the point I was trying to make. And I think everybody is focusing on the Constitution and not at the framework that actually has to be put into place. Because if you don't have a framework which allows government departments to work in an efficient way without arbitrariness, which would, and if there's no arbitrary conduct, it makes the likelihood of legal action much less. So you need an efficient framework within which the process runs, quite apart from the Constitution. And it's this part that people are not focusing on. And unless you have that, then the consequences that are outlined will happen. In other words, if you don't have an efficient process, it will have an effect on all kinds of other things. It won't just stall the land reform process, it will have an effect on the economy in general.
Quick follow-up, sir. Thank you. Just a comment, actually. Basically, what you are doing is to try to persuade us to take our attention away from the real thing. Constitution does not make explicit provisions for expropriation without land, which is what this debate is about. You're taking us on a different path. We're not examining the economy, and we're not evaluating performance by government. We're talking about constitutionality that does not protect the interests of the majority of the people. Thank you.
Let me just answer that, Mr. Chair. It needs an answer. If I pointed out in my presentation that no focus in the debate or very little focus is being placed on 25(8). 25(8) says, and I quote, "No provision of this section may impede the state from taking legislative and other measures to achieve land, water and related reform." It's very important, but people for one reason or another are not focusing on the content of that section.
Mahlo Rakata.
She's left, Chair.
Honorable Maile.
Thanks, Chair. I can hear the Helen Suzman Foundation are saying we seem to be concentrating on rural land. Now, let's go to the urban land and focus specifically on commercial land. If you observe the property relations in terms of commercial land in urban areas, you will realize that, maybe let me give you an example. In Mujaji's Kloof, the entire town is owned by one family. In Polokwane, 3/4 of Polokwane is owned by one family. Africans, all Africans who do business in Polokwane, including Mr. Chi just behind you, they are all renting. So, and you are saying if the situation is like that, then it's normal. We don't need to do anything. We don't need to change the constitution to ensure that those who don't have can also be affirmed. Is that your position?
No, it is not. We think that everybody who needs land for residential purposes or for productive purposes should have access to it. What we're saying is that changing the constitution is neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for achieving that goal.
What enough?
Thank you, Chairperson. It's a little bit of a legal question.
What I want to know is, will Parliament be wrong, legally wrong, to change the constitution before they proceed with legislation in terms of Section 25A? And can that be challenged?
Parliament can adopt legislation without changing the constitution. I think that's very clear. Obviously, that does not exclude people trying to take that legislation to the Constitutional Court to have declared it unconstitutional. One cannot avoid, one cannot predict what people will do out there. But the Constitution, as it stands, does not prevent Parliament from taking the necessary legislative measures. I think that's very clear.
Chair, can I just, I want clarity on that. In terms of, you know, of the doctrines of subsidiarity, if Parliament proceeds with a constitutional change without dealing with legislation, will that be legally correct, yes or no?
Yeah, I understood your question in another way. If Parliament changes the constitution in accordance with the constitutional requirements for majorities and process, then it can change the constitution. But whether the constitution is changed or not does not affect Parliament's ability to pass legislation. Is that clear?
Director?
If I could just amplify perhaps or complement my colleague's view, if the constitution is changed, there has to be some declaration as to why it is changing or being changed, and that could be contested. That could be taken to court. So, it's as Anton says, it's not absolutely certain that it cannot be, it cannot not be challenged.
Andre Mbumla.
Thank you. I just want to, when law is being made, it's usually for a particular reason. The constitution is the law. And therefore, if the law that is present does not address certain problems, this is why we are here. And I think this is why you are here. There are problems that are caused by our historic our history. Now I want to find out if your proposal is really assisting much. You said in your paper 67% of the land is owned by white farmers, or some black farmers, but mainly white farmers. As far as that is concerned, there are about 3.5 million farm workers. And today, the government cannot assist them, cannot house them, which it does, people outside those farms, cannot assist them with education, cannot assist them with health and also social development services. So they are permanent slaves there. Now, the law, because the owner said, this is my land, that is one thing. The other one is that the foreigners are buying land. Before we know what's going on, we'll be part of China. Or part of America, or part of Britain. I'm just making the example. Because the land belongs to people who can sell it to anybody at any time. The fourth problem is the one that you see. There are people who are starving, who are sitting, who are sleeping in the squatters. camps and so on. And they don't enjoy the freedom of this country. Now you're saying you can do that thing in any other manner? The willing buyer, willing seller, we did it. But it has failed. What has failed? Why? Because people will say, okay, government wants it. I think this place is worth 2 million. And then we have to go to court. You don't have money to do that. What I'm trying to say here is that when you say the government can do it in other manner, we personally feel that you didn't look into these problems, and that whether the present legal system addresses the problem of these things. And I think, I don't know what your comment is on that. If you say so, I'll probably listen to what you say. Thank you.
Helen Sussman Foundation, can you conclude?
Just to answer that, I think what is important is that Parliament needs to look at these questions and to address the question as to what legislation is needed to implement a structure to deal with all these issues. Because so far, Parliament has not done that. And this does not depend on the Constitution. This depends on putting in place a legislative framework and an administrative framework, and also voting the necessary funds for it. Because as I pointed out in my presentation, currently 0.3% of the national budget is devoted to land reform. Now, personally, I don't think that's sufficient, but this is an issue which has to be dealt with at government level. It does not depend on the Constitution.
Are you saying that we need to continue buying the land?
No, just to get to address the specific issue, the willing buyer, willing seller does not appear in the Constitution. It appears in the Expropriation Act of 1975, and nobody has bothered to amend that yet. I don't know what the explanation is for that.
All right, we want to thank the Helen Sussman Foundation for your effort and your presentation to enrich this parliamentary process. Thank you very much. 30 minutes for lunch.
Thank you.
30 minutes for lunch.